들어온 사나이? 아와이오? Brought your syringe with you? Syringe? Your syringe? Did you bring your syringe with you? The one that you'd put to good use all last week? You put it to good use all last week, now you brought it here to waste your time? Am I right? Or is it the other way around? Okay. So we are here to do something meaningful. I like the fact that you come here knowing what you're coming here for. Sometimes the first timers, they come in not sure why they're here. Any first timers today? First timers? Ah, we have some. Welcome. Welcome to the Rajagiri family. As you will soon find out for yourselves, won't they? Sounds a bit ominous, does it not? Most people come here because they've heard a voice on YouTube or some other social media platform. And they think, oh, he gives a good talk. And then they show up. And then they get to know you. All I do is lure them in. You're the ones who keep them. It's like the fisherman. With his, what do you call it? The fishing rod, right? The fishing rod. So the fisherman with his fishing rod, he puts the bait into the water and then he catches a fish. He brings the fish into the boat and then puts them into this container or box. Cool box. They call that the cool box. It's pretty cool in there. But he puts the fish into the box with all the other fish. Yeah? So he brings the fish in, but it's the other fish that make the new fish feel comfortable. And help it settle in. Trying to keep its mind off the inevitable destiny that awaits. My hope is that you shall never fall back into the sea, into the water. That is my hope. Because there are plenty of fish there. Swimming around. And they think that it's the worst thing if a fisherman ever catches them. So they just keep swimming around. But one day if they're lucky they get caught. So the fisherman uses a bit of bait for that. You've heard the Sinhalese phrase, "Malu anahinne katahinda kiyala." It is the mouth that spells demise for the fish, because it's the mouth that the fish uses to catch its bait. But then once it catches the bait, then there's a hook that gets entangled, and then the fish is in the boat. So you are like that fish in the boat now. So I'll bring a few fish once in a while. I will do that part. You just make sure that you keep them in the box, the cool box, until we cook them. Until we cook them and have them served. So keep them comfortable in Rajagiri until we cook them and serve them in Ingiri. Shall we begin? Wonderful. Let's bring our palms together then to make our heartfelt veneration and to pay our respectful obeisance to the Buddha, the Dhamma and the Sangha. As we do so, let us also remind ourselves that this is not a mere demonstration of our respect, but a pledge of our allegiance to the ultimate destination of unconditional happiness, the path that gets us there, and the practice that we must all undertake by ourselves. These three things are the Buddha, Dhamma, and the Sangha. Let us also then seek refuge in the Noble Triple Gem and observe the precepts, after which we will invite the countless sentient beings to join us, be amongst us. For among them may be those who are short of merits, and that might be the reason they are not among us today. But we present to them the opportunity to witness this meritorious deed. The congregation of the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who are here for their salvation. As they witness this meritorious deed, they will acquire an abundance of merits, and such merits will help them to free themselves from the woeful planes and be born in the blissful plane. This is our determination. And for all sentient beings in the blissful plane, this will serve them an opportunity to listen to the teachings of the great master, follow in his footsteps and attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. So as we are here to do that for ourselves, let us also make that opportunity available to countless others. This is our determination. So with all that in mind, let us make a start to today's proceedings.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
As you progress on this path, and as the path cultivates wisdom, when it is opportune, and I feel that you are ready, there are certain aspects that I can reveal to you. As the old saying goes, when the student is ready, the teacher appears. So you're all diligent practitioners on the Noble Path. There are some things I would not share with you right at the beginning of your journey, because it would be too soon for something like that. So given we have a regular audience, then there are those who listen to these talks online as well, who benefit from this. Because as much as I try to have them in mind as well, I do the best I can. But this is a very live interaction. If any of you are teachers and you know what it feels like to do lessons online, especially when they don't switch on their cameras. Despite your insisting requests and they still don't do it. Because you know, as a teacher, there's a certain engagement, interaction, and there's a certain connection that you want to build with your students, young or old. And the magic flows, the magic happens when that connection strengthens. And then we start to leverage that connection, both student and teacher. So it's like a path that opens. And once that path opens, it's very easy to do this interaction. So there are certain things that I might not have revealed to you right at the beginning. Sometimes it's because those things don't come to me when you're not ready. But as you become ready, then even we start to see the Dhamma in ways that we had not before. So today I feel that you are ready to listen to something that you are very familiar with. But I'm going to try and introduce to you a new perspective. I only say it is new because I presume you may not have heard this or seen this from this perspective. But the actual content, the actual subject matter is not new to you at all. In fact, from the day that you realized that you were a Buddhist, it is something that you had always been doing. Even before you knew that you were a Buddhist, very young, at the beginning of any religious function, ceremony, or anything, anything that was even vaguely religious. This is a very common practice. And I want to try and reveal another perspective to this very common practice of nothing other than the five precepts. So you all know the five precepts, don't you? It's only the five precepts. Who doesn't know the five precepts? Everyone knows the five precepts. Even today we observe the five precepts. At school, any Buddhist school, they observe the five precepts. Some of you maybe even at the workplace observe the five precepts. Whenever there is some cultural, religious event, particularly in our country, there's always the five precepts. And for many of you, you might even do it at home. There's no one to administer the precepts, but you do it anyway. For some of you, this is part of the way you start your day. You wake up in the morning, do your whatever it is you have to do, and then before you head off, maybe you offer some pan to the Buddha, maybe light an oil lamp, and perhaps before you set off, you will observe the precepts. So this precepting or observance of the precepts is a very common, very natural part of being a Buddhist. And if I asked any of you to come up and give a talk on any topic in Buddhism, I think none of you would have a problem with coming up here and talking about the five precepts. Am I right? Right, let's give it a go then, shall we? So let's get the most difficult question out of the way first. How many precepts are there in the five precepts? Five, right? Well done. So we got that one, right? So what are the five? Let's start with number one. Panatipata, Veramani, Siddhapada. So we know that these are all something to do with siksa. Sikha. Sikha is not that person who stands at the gate. Huh? From your school days? There's a sikha at this gate and pina at the other gate, right? You naughty, naughty little things. That's not the sikha I'm talking about. I'm talking about sikha pada. Hence precepts. Sikha is to train. These training hospitals, what are they called in Sinhalese? Shikshana Rohal. Yeah, Shikshana Rohal. Training hospital. So that is what Sikha is, to train. So Shiksa Pada or Sikha Pada is the precept. That is the meaning of the word, to precept, to train. Veramani is what comes before Sikha Pada. Veramani is to refrain. But not just any old refraining. Many of these terms have been anglicized and sometimes its essence is lost when you do that. That's no one's fault. It's just that some languages just don't have the words to describe some of the more subtle concepts. I think that is common in any language. When you translate one language to another, you will find across whichever barrier you go, there are words in one language which subtleties. They're not very easy to express in any other language. This can happen either way. There may be certain ideas that we really struggle to express in Sinhalese, but the idea is pretty clear in English. That's why when we speak Sinhalese, sometimes we drop a few English words. And the same is true the other way around. No? What is this no? It's not no, is it? It's nay. But nay isn't no. But we don't have the equivalent of that. You can say right. Today's Sunday, right? You could say that, but then today's Sunday, ne? So you have these subtleties. These are just linguistic complications or challenges that we come across when we do these translations. But putting that to aside, as we are here for this noble cause, it's important to try and get this meaning out, extract this meaning from these words, because words themselves don't do anything for you. Buddha is just a word. How often have we heard this word? Ever since a few weeks after we were born, we would have heard this word, Buddha. But the word itself did nothing to us. But it was later on when we started to explore what Buddha meant, the meaning behind it, the essence of it. That's when something started to happen within us. And likewise, when we say Veramani is to refrain, Veramani is something more than just refraining. For example, you have seen these notices that say, please refrain from smoking. Have you not? Please refrain from smoking. Or this is a public area. Please refrain from whatever. There may be some countries or cultures even that say, please refrain from holding hands in public. Please to refrain from displaying acts of affection. Now this is a very suitable place to display something like that, but we don't need it because you're not here to do acts of affection, you're here for salvation. This is your act of affection towards one another. It is to bring them here. You hold their hand and bring them here so that you can let go of their hand. And they can let go of yours. That's why you're here. To make it easy for them to do it. But Veeramani has a more profound meaning than that. See, it is formed of two words. This is a combination of two words. Ramana or Ramana, Ramani. Not that Ramani. You may know a few Ramanis. I'm not talking about those Ramanis. I'm talking about Ramaneya. This is to kindle, to enjoy, to indulge. Ramaneya. It's to indulge. Very simple way to think of it is to indulge. And this prefix ve suggests to avoid, or rather to cease indulgence, to stop indulgence. So this is not just to refrain then. So when you say please refrain from smoking, that does not suggest that you somehow understand the perils of smoking and you give up smoking. It's simply to suggest that in this place, as much as you would like to, please don't do it. That is what it means in that context, isn't it? As much as you might like to, please don't do it here. Do you think when someone reads that sign, then they're going to make a determination, that's it, I realize now, smoking's not good for me, I'm never going to do that again? No, that is not the intention of that signage, and it is not the impact that it has on the reader either. For that, they must, of course, visit maybe a doctor, understand what smoking does to them. So this is not mere refraining, although we use that as a loosely translated word. We will see any number of books where it says, Panatipata Veeramani Sikkhapadam. What is the English translation of that? It will say, I refrain from taking others' lives. But I'm here to suggest to you today that Veeramani is not just refraining. It's the cessation of indulgence. The cessation of indulgence. Think of some things that you are indulged in right now. Not right now, but generally. What things do you seek indulgence in? Chocolate. Do you indulge in chocolate? Ice cream? All sorts of puddings and desserts and stuff like that. You can indulge in music. Drama, movies. These are things you can indulge in. Not you can, but it's what people do. People indulge in these things. Don't you do? People do, not you. You're not here to indulge. There's only one thing you're supposed to indulge in, that is the Dhamma. This is what we talked about last week. Because indulgence in anything else leaves you where? Leaves you empty. Yeah? Hopefully you reflected on that throughout the course of last week. This syringe business. You know, all that effort is to leave an imprint in your mind that you can take away, carry when you leave this room as you go about doing your day-to-day business. Perhaps a long sermon might not come to mind, but the visual imagery, as you go sit in front of the TV and you pick up your remote, if at that moment you can remember, what am I doing right now? Just syringing this into my mind, isn't it? What is the point of doing this? So it is for that I use these props, so that they can leave a lasting mental, visual image in your mind. You know, that is as good as a pirith thread that goes around your wrist. Because as far as I see it, there may be a more spiritual side to this, a metaphysical side to it, but I'm a very realistic individual. So the way I try to look at it is how it has an impact on our day-to-day lives. So the pithi thread that goes around your wrist is a very strong reminder to you as you extend your hand, which is typically how you engage with others. And typically it goes on your right hand, doesn't it? Your good arm, as they say. Whereas for mine, it's my left. So if I wanted my pithi thread, I would have it on my left. But I have a pithi rope. I don't need a thread anymore. I am the pithi thread. But this pithi thread that goes on your wrist is a reminder to you as you extend yourself out to others and you see it, what am I about to do? Is it right that I do this? Am I doing the right thing? Do I have the right intentions here? In that way, it gives you protection. Then you don't need to worry whether the pithi thing itself infuses some kind of protection into the thread or not. Then you don't need to get entangled in that conversation at all. Because some people will say that that is so. And are we here to deny? No, we don't need to. But we understand that it could be a protection for as long as your mind is reminded the purpose of your engagements with others. So coming back to Veeramani then, what we are precepting ourselves to do, ladies and gentlemen, is to refrain from indulgence. To free ourselves from indulgence. And then there are five indulgences that these five precepts relate to. So it's not just the last one. Because that seems to be a pretty obvious one. I refrain from indulging myself in the intoxicants. Oh, how convenient it is when we think that it is simply to do with alcoholic substances. Because then you can drink any amount of Fanta. That's okay. Because that's not an intoxicant. Only those that you see in the liquor aisle, those are the intoxicants. Everything else is fine. And you think the Buddha said that. We find ourselves in this predicament when we maybe even conveniently choose to ignore the fact that it was the Buddha who taught these things to us. Then we start to take things so lightly and lose all its gravity and the essence and the profoundness behind it. My invitation to you is, let's not forget that it was the Buddha who gave us all these things. The Noble Triple Gem, the precepts, the refuge, all of this was given to us by the Buddha. If these are gifts of the Buddha, let me give you an analogy. Let's say you have a very rich friend. A very rich friend. Okay? He's a very rich friend. He or she is a very rich friend. And for your birthday, they give you a gift. Just a little box, all wrapped up. You know, quite very small, relatively small. You can hold it in one hand. And then there's a friend who is not rich at all, actually very poor. They also give you a box about the same size, both wrapped. Okay? So we open the box that was given to you by the poor friend first, let's assume. And in there you find a toffee. How sweet, right? What's in there? Toffee. Any surprises? Are you surprised by that? Why are you not surprised by the fact that she has given you a gift and it's a toffee? Because she's poor. She's poor. That's all she can afford. But what if you find the same thing in the other box? A very rich friend gives you a gift, same size box. Do you even expect to find the same thing in that box? Even if it's the same size? And the smaller the box, what do you think? I mean, if it's a big thing, then you already assume that it must be, you know, something pretty big. But the smaller the box and the richer the friend, when these two factors align, I'll plot it on a graph, richness, box size. So as the friend gets richer and the box gets smaller, what do your wild imaginations tell you is in the box? Something very, very precious. You understand the analogy? Right, now let's bring that back to the sasana. So the Buddha comes along. Who are we talking about? The Supreme Buddha. So he comes along and he gives you a gift. It's a box. Do you expect to open that box and find a few toffees in there? So in the same vein, he gives you the five precepts. Do you expect to just find the five precepts in there? The superficial, what seems to be like the meaning behind it? Don't kill. Don't steal. Don't you know what? Don't lie. And then the one that is famous among these are, you know, Friday nights, Saturday nights, this gets tossed around a lot, this last one, where the Buddha said, have but not a lot, in moderation. Yeah, that's what the Buddha said. That's why they made these little shot glasses. Not those beakers. It's because in the Western world they have beakers, right? Where you put beer. So then they found the Buddha's teachings and so replaced the beers with the shot glasses. Yeah? Yeah. All this because we have forgotten who it is that gave these gifts to us. We are speaking of the fount of wisdom. The omniscient one is who we are talking about. And he is also the one who has infinite compassion towards all sentient beings. Therefore, I think it is incumbent upon us, with the help of our teachers and the Dhamma that we have understood, to explore the depths of these gifts. So I know that there's a very popular book, What the Buddha Said, or What the Buddha Taught. Which one is it? By the Venerable Walpole Rahula Theru? What the Buddha Taught, I think it is. So then I presume there's also another book called What the Buddha Said. I'm proposing to you another one, What the Buddha Might Have Said. And then in subscript, But We Fail to Understand. Within brackets, believe that due to our ignorance. So what the Buddha might have said, but what we fail to understand due to our ignorance. So then when we replace that ignorance with wisdom, then we don't fail to understand, we succeed in understanding what the Buddha might have said. Actually, what the Buddha might have meant. And in that light, I wish to use some part of our time today to make this bold claim that although you have been observing the five precepts for as long as you can remember, if you can stay true to at least one of them, then you are already on the noble path. And quite frankly, unless you are a sotapanna, true observance of these precepts is virtually impossible. And as soon as I say this, you're probably thinking, but Swaminas, I don't kill. I don't kill. I have enough to for myself and my family. So I don't steal. I don't need to steal. I don't steal because I don't need to steal. I'm happily married, so I have my spouse. Therefore, I don't need to indulge in any other kind of gratification. I don't go in search of any other kind of sensual satisfactions. Therefore, I don't need any of that. And I never lie. That's the biggest lie of all, but I don't lie. I always think to myself, of the five precepts, the fourth one is the one that people break as soon as they leave. As soon as they leave the room. So I don't lie. And then last one, I've been a teetotaler all my life. You know, maybe a few years ago, a few decades ago, you know, I would have just, you know, I experienced it because of peer pressure. It's always the peers who have to take the blame for everything we do. We are innocent, aren't we? Always. We are always innocent. It's the peers. It's always the peers. What do the peers say? What do the peers say? They say the same thing. They're also innocent. It's always the peers. And so the fifth one does not apply to me because I don't drink anyway. I'm a teetotaler. Therefore, the five precepts is just, you know, I can do it in my sleep. Observing and adhering to the five precepts, you know, I can do it in my sleep. Okay, agreed. If you choose to ignore the fact that it was the Buddha who gave us the five precepts. If it were Mahatma Gandhi who gave us the five precepts, yes, I can understand this. A much loved and a man who lived a very honorable life. I can imagine the Mahatma Gandhiji, asking his people. I can imagine Mahatma Gandhi asking his people to avoid and refrain from these sinful acts. I can imagine that. It makes perfect sense to me. Do not kill, because his philosophy was one of nonviolence. So yeah, I can totally understand that. Don't steal is very reasonable to think that Mahatma Gandhi would have asked us to do something like that, or to refrain from stealing. And he was a man who dedicated his life to something more than himself, to his country, to his nation, to his people. So to indulge in any kind of sensual gratification, where would have he had found the time to do any of that? And so for his mission, for his movement, I can imagine he would have asked people to come along and to join him. There was no time for any of that nonsense. And I doubt he would have lied. And I really don't think he had any time to indulge in intoxicants. So from Mahatma Gandhi, I can expect these five precepts in the way that we understand them today, in the conventional sense. But the moment you switch the register and you say that this is from the Buddha, once you understand anicca, dukkha and anatta, and how the Buddha's purpose of preaching the Dhamma was to free us from the 31 realms of existence, to cease this process of jati that happens within us, this sense of separation, to free us from our identities. Just imagine that. That was what the Buddha's efforts were to. To free us from our identities. Where that was his ultimate goal, I struggle to understand how it is that the Buddha would have just asked us to do those five things and off you go on your way. That is why to this audience, to an audience who have been studying the Dhamma, not as scholars, but as students. Do you understand the difference? The saying doesn't go, when the scholar appears, the teacher appears. Or when the scholar is ready, the teacher appears. That's not how it goes, right? It's when the student is ready, because the student is one who learns for internal transformation. A scholar is one who learns for scholarly achievements, getting good grades in their exams and whatnot. So then, ladies and gentlemen, in that light, I want to talk to you about the five precepts today. Please have it in the back of your mind that it was the Buddha who taught it. Some of what I say might not sink in immediately. So the first thing I want to say as we embark on this journey is I am not refuting or denying that the conventional idea, the commonly accepted interpretation of the five precepts is invalid. I'm not suggesting that. So those five precepts are here with us and they shall remain till the end of time. And should all good Buddhists adhere to them? Why not? Actually, my answer is, why not? Why not? And so when you hear perhaps another talk, or someone else say that the first precept is to refrain from killing, don't you be the weird one who stands up in the audience and say, no, it's not that, it's this. Because then you don't have the base of the Dhamma on which I'm trying to build this wall up. Because our effort is for personal salvation, isn't it? That is our agenda, personal salvation. We are not here to rectify the world or change conventions or try and tear the fabric of society. This is not what we are here to do. We are only here for personal salvation. Each and every one of you must understand that you are here alone at this time. Your Nibbana, your practice, is a very personal affair. If there's anyone else who's interested, encourage them to take a personal journey on this, on the Dhamma. Something that I'm very humbly happy about myself is that whenever I come across someone and they decide that they want to preach to me, I shut up and I listen. I don't care what they say. I have had such experiences myself as well. As much, I understand a little bit of Dhamma. But there are times when I come across people who understand even less, yet they feel that it is their turn to teach me. So when that happens, I know my place. I simply switch off and I listen. We learn when we stop speaking. Others learn about us. Others learn the donkey, the fool we are when we start talking. But we learn when we stop speaking, because then we are listening. These are really valuable lessons that my teachers taught me, and I am glad sunk in to me before even the Dhamma did. And that is what made the fertile ground for the Dhamma to take root. So, once again, I will share this wisdom with you, but I need your assurance that I'm not handing over weapons to you. You can take these weapons for self-destruction, but not to, not for conflict, not for friction, not to debate or argue with others, be that members of the clergy or members of the lay community. Will you promise me that? Will you? Otherwise, you are not qualified to listen to not just this, but any talk for that matter. Because I am not then at ease or at liberty to share some of this insight with you if I feel that you are going to use it for the wrong reason, for the wrong purpose. Let's take the first precept then. This is a training. Hence, Sikkhapada. This is about Vairamani. This is to cease indulgence. And this is true across all five of them. The first thing I want to say about this particular precept is once you have trained yourself by this precept, okay, listen carefully. Once you have trained yourself by this precept, the morality that this precept encapsulates is the natural disposition, the natural mental, virtuous, spiritual disposition of a stream enterer, of the Sotapanna. Once again, once you have trained this precept, once you have trained the precept of Panatipata Vairamani, so Sikkhapada, so to train. Once you have trained this precept, train yourself in this precept, upon completion of that training, your natural disposition, not by willpower, not by determination, not by resolve, okay, not out of patience, none of that. I'm talking about your natural disposition. Your natural disposition aligns with this precept. It's no longer a precept then. It becomes who you are. Panatipata Vairamani becomes who you are when you are a Sotapanna. Sakrudagami, Adinnadana Vairamani becomes your natural disposition when you are a Sakrudagami individual. Kamesu Michachara Vairamani becomes your natural disposition when you are an Anagami individual. And you thought this was for lay people. I am here to tell you that you cannot live by even the second precept until and unless you become a Sakrudagami individual. Forget Kamesu Michachara. Kamesu Michachara Vairamani becomes your natural disposition. As in, that training is complete, done. Only once you achieve the state of a non-returner into the karma worlds. Until then, you're in training. But what good is there in training for the third if you are not even at the first stage? What good is it to train for the third if you're not at the second stage? What good is it to train for the second if you're not at the first stage? This goes one stage at a time. The fourth precept, Musavada Vairamani, That becomes your natural disposition. Only at least once you have reached the Antara Paranibbaya stage. And the fifth one, to drink in moderation. That becomes a natural disposition. That becomes who you are only once you attain pure arahanthood. I will explain to you why that is and how it is and all that. But I first want you to understand the gravity of this. Because we have become so casual about it. The five precepts. Sometimes they say, you know, I observe it in the morning, must I observe it again in the evening? Once a week is enough, isn't it? If I haven't broken my precepts, then surely I don't have to take it again. The reason for this thinking is that we think that it is one of those things that we have to observe. Like, I wear white on Sundays. It's an observance. I'm vegetarian on poya days. What is that? It's an observance. Why can't you be vegetarian every day? For obvious reasons. The least of them is health. Mainly for other reasons. It's what Guru Handra talked about the other day. How you don't eat food, but food eats you. So this is not a conversation about vegetarianism. I'm just saying, you know, that is an observance that some people adhere to. Poya days, I don't eat meats or fish or anything non-veg. Poya days, I go to the temple. That's an observance. In the weekends, I wear my sarong. That's an observance. Monday to Friday, I wear my tie. That's an observance. These are observances. Therefore, to even suggest let's observe the five precepts doesn't really agree with the Buddha's, with what the Buddha really gave us. But it's a convention. Like I said again, I'm not here to shatter convention. So even after you heard this sermon, start to finish. When we come back here next week, what's the first thing we will do? If I remember to? Observe the. I will administer the precepts and you shall observe them. So when I say please repeat after me, you will repeat after me. But if you understand what I'm about to share with you today, you will realize that there's nothing to repeat. There's nothing to administer. This is your practice on the noble path. But when I ask you to repeat next week, please repeat, okay? Don't you be the smart you-know-who in the audience. I am not going to repeat any of that now. I understand what the precepts are. So we must never be weird and awkward in society. Whenever society feels that we are not one of them, it leaves a lot of tension there. So wherever you are, you've got to try and be one of them. Internally be whoever you are. You know, retain your integrity. Keep your integrity. Never hurt or never let circumstances damage your integrity. Because that's what you have to take to your deathbed. That's what you will take to your grave. That's what you will take with you when you fall asleep at night. Your integrity. So keep your integrity, but your outwardly behavior, align that as much as you possibly can, within reason, to what your community at that time, the people you're with, expect of you. When you mingle, then it's easy to get along that way. Otherwise, you become the weird one. You become that so thumb. You become that horn. Then people make life difficult for you, and life can become very difficult. So in the same way, here we are talking about the precepts. I'm not suggesting to you for one moment, that from here on you should not observe the precepts. So wherever you are, whenever you are, if someone says, let's now observe the precepts, we will repeat. Okay? But this is for your spiritual advancement. Before the precepts are administered, Swami Nuance typically says, let's chant the Namaskara. How many times? 3 times. Why only 3? See, this Namaskara, I often remind you, let this not simply be a mark of our respect to the Buddha, because that is what we normally feel it as. You know, we bring our hands together to show our respect. Yeah, we get down on our knees in front of our parents, our teachers, the clergy, to show our respect. As if they expect our respect. You know, that's true in the forces. It might be true in the office. When your seniors come in, you have to stand up. Because they expect that. That's part of how the system works. But do you think the Buddha expects your respect? So he gave up all his defilements, except for one. That is, he expects our respect. Could he be the Buddha then? No. As parents, you will expect respect from your children. Sometimes it's not just for their benefit, but also for yours, because it gives you just a little kick, a little boost for your pride. At least there's someone in this world. No one in this world cares at all about me, but at least, you know, these my offspring. At least they stand up. At least they respect. At least they stop speaking when I start speaking. Some of you are laughing at me. Swami Nuance, you come home with me and see. Take my children over for a day and see. But at least there's someone to respect us. And that gives us a little bit of a boost to our pride. Makes us feel good when people respect us. But the Buddha cannot be someone like that, can he? Someone who expects respect? You think the Arahatun Mahan says expect respect? No, they don't. And if they ought to be respected, okay? If they ought to be respected, why do we limit ourselves to 3? Is that the extent of our respect to them? Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Okay, 1. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Okay, 2. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. 3. No more. Don't you think I'm going to give you any more? Really? The Buddha? After all that sacrifice and austerities and countless eons of his suffering to redeem us from samsara, all we can give him is 3 namaskar. That's it. No more than that. Really, we should be spending all day and night, every waking moment, just chanting Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Don't you think so? If a mouth can speak, such a mouth should only be uttering those words. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. That's all we should be saying and nothing more. Because the very fact that we have that to say, we have a Buddha to show our respect to, alone deserves our infinite, limitless respect. And therefore we should be spending every waking moment just chanting that. So why do we limit ourselves to just 3? Why don't we go for four? Why not five? Now this is a time for us to reflect. So these are questions I throw at you, not because I want you to spit out answers, but I want you to contemplate. And that helps others as well. I'm a strong believer in the fact that if you teach someone, if you give someone the answers, they'll remember it. If you bring the answers out of from them, then they will understand, they will learn from them. So I often like to ask questions in a way that prompts the right answer to come out of them. It's something we do at the monastery a lot. So I ask you, why three? There are three types of Buddhas. What are they? There are the Arahat Buddhas, and there are the Paccheka Buddhas, and the Sammasambuddhas. So then, as Swaminarayan is suggesting, that this is our show of respect to the three Buddhas. Perhaps. That's halfway there. You could consider that to be the case. I'm suggesting let's not just show our respect, but let's do it meaningfully. And because there are three Buddhas, let's give them one namaskara each. So the thing is this. Now, when you give one namaskara each, previously the Supreme Buddha got all three. Yeah? And we were just discussing how he deserves much more than that. So now all of a sudden we are now allocating two of the of those namaskaras to the two other Buddhas. Now he's left with just one. That's a foul deal, isn't it? From the Buddha's perspective, he gets one third of the respect that he got previously. So then this is something more than paying respect. Because they don't expect respect. They've cultivated their minds to a point where they expect neither love nor respect from others. Their purpose in life has become to share love and respect with others. Give it to, not get from. That is the transformation that has happened within them. That is how they have become Buddhas. The reason you are not a Buddha yet is because you expect love and respect from others. That's one way to test it. It's a good litmus test. If you expect love from others, be that your children, be that your spouses, be that your fiancé, fiancée, girlfriends, boyfriends, friends, anyone. If you expect love and respect from others, that is because there's a void. Isn't there? It's only when there's a void for something it is expected to come from other places. Am I right? How does the wind flow? How does the wind blow? From an area of high pressure to a area of low pressure. So the area of low pressure is where there is not much air. Therefore there's a void. Relatively speaking. In the same way, if we expect love and respect, what that tells us is we don't have enough of that here. So once you become a source of love, as Guru Chandra very beautifully puts it, once you become love itself, then why would you expect love from others? When you are love, does love look for love? When you become love itself, then you don't expect it from others. When you become respect itself, then you don't expect it from others. Then your purpose in life becomes not one of seeking, but one of giving. Because you become the fountain of love. You become the fountain of respect. A fountain constantly gives. the ocean constantly receives. When is the ocean satisfied? Have you ever seen a satisfied ocean? The rivers flow, taking water to the oceans. On which days of the week? Public holidays and weekends. Every day the rivers flow, taking water from the hills, from the springs, all the way down to the ocean. But when does the ocean go enough? Never does, because it's never satisfied. Unlike the springs, you don't have to feed the spring. The spring is the source. Which one's bigger, the ocean or the spring? Oh, of course the ocean's bigger. Being that big, still, it still expects water to come to it. That's the way the ocean is. It's massive, but never enough. Therefore, abundance is not to be found in size or quantity. See how many lessons we can learn just from observing nature. Quantity is not a measure of abundance. You think to have in abundance is to have lots. Then look at the ocean and the spring. The ocean has an infinite amount of water, nearly infinite amount of water, but it's never satisfied. Always asks for more. Can I have some more? 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 Whereas the spring is not an abundant source of water. Relatively speaking, it's very small in size, but all it does is it just spews out the water day and night. Take it, take it, take it, take it. I don't need it. I don't need anything for myself. Just take it, take it, take it all, take it all, take it all. Therefore, abundance is not a measure of, or rather, quantity is not a measure of abundance. So, do you have in abundance? Wait, let me check my bank account first. No, there's nothing to check to confirm whether you have in abundance. You don't need to check anything. You check within. This is where abundance springs. Not in your material things. It's not in the amount of money you have, wealth, property. It's none of those things. Have you not seen people who have lots, but they're not satisfied inside? You try and ask them for something, they say, no, not enough. I need for money, I need for my son, I need for my daughter, I need for my family, I need for my people, can't give. Then there's the beggar on the street. All he gets is one slice of bread. And what he will do is, if another beggar comes along, he will break it in half and says, here you go. He doesn't think about his tomorrow. Because for now, he has abundance. That is the attitude of abundance. It is not to be measured in quantity. Back to Panadipata. These are the sidetracks. I can't help. And you don't help me either, because you are all looking at me going. So you just lead me along. What can I do? Sometimes I feel like Alice in Wonderland. So many rabbit holes. Anyway, back to Panadipata. Where was I just before we ventured into this? Meandering into this, what happened? Are we talking about Surameera, weren't we? No. I said that was the natural disposition of the Rahatan Vahanse. Somehow that... Stages. Okay. Back to stages then. So, Panadipata. Let's have a think about what Panadipata means. I am not refuting or denying that it is to refrain from killing. So please don't take that away from today. So this is not a kill anyone license or kill anything license I'm handing over to you. Okay? So please don't say that or think that or do that. And otherwise you say, no, I was harmless until I came to the Dharmistra Rajagiriya community. Now I'm like Angulimala. I just go on killing sprees. This is not that. And in a conventional sense, if someone asks you, what is Panatipata, what is the meaning? To refrain from killing. If anyone asks you, it is that. When you ask yourself, here's the answer. Let's take the Prutakjana for a second. The Prutakjana is an individual who is yet to listen to the teaching. Asrutava Prutakjana. Asrutava meaning someone who hasn't heard. Someone who hasn't heard the Dhamma. Someone who hasn't heard the Buddha's teaching is a Prutakjana. Because without hearing the Buddha's teachings, you cannot become a stream enterer. So Asrutava is not heard. Someone who hasn't heard the Paticca-samuppada. These are not the words of the Paticca-samuppada, but the essence of Paticca-samuppada. Jati, avidya, tanha, leading to jati, anicca, dukkha, anatta, these things. So just because you've heard a few jataka stories, doesn't make you a sotapa. That is still an asutava putakjana. Because nahi silena vatang hotu upajjanti tathagata. The Buddha's advent is not to teach us about precepts, not some observances, but of three words and eight syllables. Anicca, dukkha and anatta, the essence of everything. Attakaratini pada sambuddhena pakasita. This is what the Buddha has claimed. If that is what is to, so prakasha is to publish, to express. What it is he has expressed is anicca dukkha anatta. Then what it is, what was it, what is it we must have heard to become a srutava aryasavako? It is what he has expressed. So what the Buddha has expressed is anicca dukkha anatta. Therefore, for us to become a srutava aryasavako is to have heard anicca dukkha anatta. Take the mentality of a prutakjana. Remember the other day I explained to you what a prutakjana is? Potu, jana. Potu meaning the shaf, yes. This is the cover around the grain. I gave you the example of a farmer. When did we do that talk? Moon talk. After the moon talk. So a farmer who cultivates his land in the hope of chaff. Oh, he wants grain, but all that grows is chaff. Then what's the point of his cultivation? This is the part that you throw away. It's what you discard. Because the grain is what you need. Likewise, a prutakjana is someone who, in the hope of real happiness, indulges in various things that does not yield happiness, only the chaff. He wants the grain, which is the equivalent of happiness, but only gets the chaff, which is the equivalent of sorrow, grief, emptiness, which also links us back to last week's talk. Emptiness. So that is a prutakjana. Now then, ladies and gentlemen, for a prutakjana, what is their philosophy of happiness? You're looking at me like, why are you asking us, Swami? For a prutakjana, not you, for a prutakjana, what is their philosophy for happiness? Here's the philosophy in very simple words, right? There are things that make me happy. And the more I can acquire them, the more I can make them mine, the happier I am. And then there are things that make me unhappy. When I say things, it could be people, could be events, could be outcomes, anything. Okay? There are things that make me unhappy, and the more I can distance myself from them, the happier I am. Isn't this the mindset of a Prithakjana? Yes? So there are things that make me happy, such as nice, those nice things. All those nice things that you give a list of, nice food, nice clothes, nice music, nice films, nice people, nice house, a nice car, nice the rest of it. The more I can acquire them, the happier I am. Then there's another half to it. What is it? Things that are not nice, meaning things that don't make me happy, what do I want to do with them? Distance myself from them. This is the mindset of a Prithakjana. All in agreement with that? Okay. So then, to a Prithakjana, there are two types of people in this world. There are friends, and then there are, shall we say, enemies. Who are the friends? Who are his friends? Those who do what? Help him. Help him to do what? Acquire the things that he wants and distance himself from the things that he doesn't want, doesn't like. Those are his friends, or his amigos. Then he has the enemies. Who are the enemies? Those who bring upon him the things that he doesn't want to have, and those who take away from him the things that he wants to have. Yes? Isn't that how you define your friends as well? Not noble friends. But in a conventional way, you associate with people you think as friends because they bring you the things that you like. And they somehow do something they're possible, whatever possible, to try and distance you or keep you away from things that you don't like. That's why when you're in trouble, who do you call? When you're in trouble, who do you call? A friend. You want their help. That's when you know whether they're a friend or not. Because when you're in trouble, they don't answer. Yeah? When they're in trouble, they always answer. When you have something, they'll answer. When you won the lottery, oh, they answer. Of course they do. This is how you can tell your friends, apart from the non-friends or the enemies. So, do you see, when you have this Prithakjana mentality, people in this world are now categorized into two groups, the friends and the enemies. And every subject you come across, you have this question in my mind, which basket do I put them into? And for that you have that initial conversation with them. Hey, how are you doing? Where are you from? What do you do? What do you do for a living? Oh, interesting questions. Why is what do you do for a living an interesting question? Come on. Why is what they do for a living an interesting question to you? Because as they give the answer out, what are you thinking? How can I benefit from that? It's a very natural instinct. And a very natural reaction. You can't help it. It happens. That is because of the Prithakjana mindset. We always try to put people into these two categories. So that's one aspect. There's another aspect I want to talk to you about. When you take the 31 realms of existence, so there are the hells, the human world, the heavens and the Brahma worlds. From your perspective, who's having a good time? Who's having a good time? Hells or the heavens? The heavens. So anyone who has more than you is having a good time. That's why you want to become like them. so that you can also have a good time, a better time. Anyone who has less than you is what? Of course, they're not having a good time. You're going to try and sometimes help them to have a good time. If you're feeling particularly generous, you might help them. So once again, you have split these sentient beings into two categories. Those who are having the good, those who are having a good time versus those who are not having such a good time. See, two categories again. In these 31 realms of existence, we typically tend to draw a divide and say, this is the Sugati, this is the Dugati. So the animal realm, the preta worlds and all that we put into this Dugati side. The human world, the heavenly abodes and the Brahmic worlds, we put them into the Sugati side. Again, we split the world up into these two categories. Now, if you take both of these measures into consideration, the ultimate outcome is that you have split people or beings, not necessarily people, but beings into two categories. One category is above the other. One is better than the other. One is good, the other is bad. In very simple terms, one is better and the other is worse. Yes? Meaning, one is Ati and the other is Pata. Ati is better. Pata, worse. One are the friends, the others are the enemies. One is better, the other is worse. One's in the Sugati worlds, the other's in the Dugati worlds. Ati and Pata. So, who's in this Ati and Pata group? All beings. Pranin. All beings. So all beings you have now put into two categories. One is the Ati group, other is the Pata group. Pana Ati, Pata. Pana is the Pranin beings. One in the good group, the other in the bad group. Why? Relative to you. So relative to you, all beings are now in one of two groups. Friends, enemies, living the good life, not so good life, bad life, they're worse off. There are beings who have what you want. There are beings who don't have what you want. Can I ask you a question? This dichotomy, the have what I want and don't have what I want, it is dependent on one factor, is it not? Who's the one with the knife? Or who's the one with the pair of scissors? Who's the one with the pen that draws the line? You are. What you're suggesting is, relative to you, there are pranin who are either Ati or Pata. Meaning relative to your needs and wants, relative to your desires, relative to your wishes, all beings are now in one of two groups. These are my friends and my enemies, those who have what I want, those who don't have what I want. Do you see that you are now able to split this world up into two? All prani into two groups. Relative to which prani? You prani. Relative to the I prani. Relative to the me prani. So for as long as you exist, for as long as you exist, you become the point of reference. Yes? Yes, ladies and gentlemen? As I said, I can only continue this conversation based on your understanding of the Dhamma. If you have no understanding of what this I business is, what this sense of self, how can I even consider giving this talk to you? I won't even bother starting. So relative to you, because you exist, when we say you exist, really that's just a bunch of desires. What are you if not a mere bunch of desires? Take away all the desires, what's left of you? If I strip you of all your desires, what's left of you? Then what are you? Don't drop your head. Look up and look in my eyes and tell me. Don't look down in embarrassment. Look at me in my eyes and tell me, what are you? Just a whole bunch of yuck. Good Buddhists we are, aren't we? Good Buddhists we are. Strip you of your desires and you are nobody. So you see, for as long as you exist, meaning desires exist, you can now split this world up in two. One is the Ati and the other is the Pata. Ati is high, Pata is low. Yes, Ati is high. Pata is low. So all pranin, all beings, are now split in two groups. The Panati and the Pana Pata. But what happens the day you understand this I is the problem? See, this is the Pruthakjana. Why is this a Pruthakjana? Go back to that shaft. The Pruthakjana does not understand the problem is with the sense of self. His definition of a problem is when he doesn't have what he wants. This is his definition of sorrow, grief, the 11 great fires. This is his definition of happiness, to have what he wants. Therefore, he favors this side, disfavors the other, this side. Where does he want to find himself? On which side of the fence? On that side of the fence. Therefore, he keeps on exerting himself. He uses his life to try and keep himself on this side, to associate with this side, to dissociate himself with this side. Yes, he might have sympathy towards this, but he doesn't want to be there. Do you want to become someone who you sympathize with? Do you ever feel that? I want to become someone who I sympathize with? No, you want to help them, but you don't want to become one of them, right? Who do you want to become? Someone who sympathizes with? You want to become like someone who sympathizes with? With whom? With you, of course. So that you can continue to, or you can then start to sympathize with those who were like you in the past. So the Pruthakjana's definition of happiness is life on this side of the fence. The Pruthakjana's definition of unhappiness is life on this side of the fence. Therefore, he wishes to disassociate himself with the Pata, Pranin, and he likes to spend his time with the Ati, Pranin. Whose life story am I talking about here, you think? I mean, not you, you are saints, right? Surely. I am the only sinner in this room. Now he comes along one day and listens to the Buddha. This individual comes across the Buddha's teaching. All this time in life and all this time in samsara, he thought that life on this side was good, but life on this side was bad. He considered the Sugati worlds, the heavenly abodes, his destinations. That is where he wanted to be, in the heavens. He didn't want to go to hell. He was a good man, yes, I don't deny. But he didn't want to go to hells because he thought it was beings in the hells, it was beings in the lowly planes that suffered, whereas beings in the heavenly planes, they enjoyed, they had a good life. But what does the Buddha teach us? What does the Buddha teach us? Does the Buddha say that the heavenly beings have a good life? Why not? Because they also suffer from the sense of self. Does the Buddha say that the king has it good but the beggar has it bad? In his teaching? Does he? No. We are talking about the Four Noble Truths. We're talking about the Four Noble Truths now. When I say the Buddha's teaching, I'm referring to the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths apply to whom? The kings or the beggars? The peasants? It appears to all sentient beings. Therefore, once this Prithakjana listens to the teaching of the Buddha, and then he realizes that the problem is not on this side and the solution on the other side, he realizes the problem is this, and the solution is freedom from this. When this is the problem, ladies and gentlemen, pay attention now. When this is the problem, is it those on this side who have it bad and this side have it good? Then everyone's they're on the same boat. Everyone's in the same boat. Every prani, all prani, have the same problem. That's when you can come to this mentality of Sielu prana bhutin kirihi hitanu kampiva kata. That's why you now observe this new precept. Sabba sattesu. Sabba sattesu. Metta sahagatena chetasa viharanam samadhiyami. Sabba sattesu. Sabba sattesu meaning? On this side or this side? Both sides. Sabba satta is those who have a sense of self. This is the sabba satta. All minds with a sense of self. This is the literal translation of sabba satta. If you go back to the mindset of the Prithakjana, he tries to show metta to those on this side. Paune. Sinno. Yeah, so he tries to show metta to beings on this side. Whereas beings on that side, he wishes for metta from those on that side. So he walks up to them, show me some metta. Please. That's why we have these words, please. What is please? A plead for? A bit of what? A bit of metta. That's what this word is, this magical word, please. It's a request for a bit of metta. Please. Do you think he goes up here and says, please? Does he say please? No, he says, say thank you. Say thank you. Basically what he's saying is, please me. That's how the same word but has different meanings depending on which side of the fence it is, isn't it? See, you can use please here and please here as well. How is that? What he does when he goes onto that side is, he says, please, please. It's a request. Whereas on this side, he expects them to please him. Why? This is the Prithakjana mindset. But the Buddha comes along. Now, the Four Noble Truths understands that the problem is not to be found on that side or this side. The problem is that there is a side. So when they realize that this is the problem, the sense of I is the problem, then everyone is in the same boat. Now where does he show his compassion? This side or that side? Both sides. If he still feels the sense of self for himself or within himself, then that compassion extends to him as well as all other beings. Because he understands the problem is neither to have nor not to have. It is to be. That is the problem. Sorry, Shakespeare. Like he once said, to be or not to be, that's the problem. True. So it's not to have or not to have, but it's to be or not to be. Once he has understood this, now, are there Atiprana and Pataprana? Any more Atipranas? Those who have what I want? Once he has understood that wanting is the problem, are there Atipranas? Pataprana's? No. So then, he no longer sees the world from that perspective. Therefore, the natural disposition of someone who has come to this realization is that there are no Atipranas and Pataprana's. Panatipata Veramani. That is his natural disposition. How do you take that understanding away from a Sotapanna? Is it possible? Do you think a Sotapanna would ever go back to this thinking? Is there a reverse path on this? No. That's why I say it's his natural disposition. It is not out of willpower, not out of determination, not out of resolve, not because of patience. It is not that. It has become his intrinsic morality. This virtue no longer needs to be sustained. It has become part of him. It is who he is. That's why I said, these precepts once trained become who you are. So you tell me then again, ladies and gentlemen, just the precepts, right? Just the precepts. Just a toffee given to us by the Buddha. It's just the precepts, right? It's the bit before the sermon, isn't it? It's only the bit before the sermon. It's okay to miss that part. The sermon's the important part. It's like just like the warm-up before the exercise, right? You can still come and do the exercise. Don't need the warm-up. Don't you feel like we have been undermining the Buddha quite a bit? For whenever we thought that the Buddha just came along and said, non-violence, I don't want you to kill others, I don't want you to kill other beings. This is what I teach you, don't kill other beings. I have always asked this question of you, do you need the Buddha to come and teach us that? Do you need the Buddha, the supremely enlightened one, to come and teach you that killing is bad? Ask a little one. Ask a 10-year-old, do you want to be killed? Then do you think you should do it to others? You don't need to preset the guy, he understands. Any little kid understands that what you don't want to happen to you, you should not do to others. It's our basic common sense, our basic compass, our basic moral compass. We have it, we are all born with it. What we don't like to do to us, we don't want to do to others. That I think one of those days I told you, make that your religion. If you don't understand, if you don't have a religion, let that be your religion. Humanity. What you don't want to happen to you, don't do to others. That's a good compass, a moral compass. So then to think that the Buddha's objective of preaching the, giving us the precepts is to merely ask us to refrain from killing, I think it's a huge understatement. But if someone asks you tomorrow, what is the meaning of the first precept, what would you say? To observe the precept of abstaining from killing. But for your own practice, what is the first precept? To understand that all sentient beings are the same. The problem that they all have is the sense of jati, or the sense of self, which is jati. Therefore, there are no ati and there are no patha prani. Therefore, to practice this precept is to practice anicca, dukkha and anatta. How can you come to this understanding without practicing anicca, dukkha and anatta? If you ask me, these were precepts that the Buddha gave to bhikkhus. But don't ask me where in the Tripitaka it shows this. I cannot give you any references to this. What I am sharing with you right now, if you ask me, give me references, I can't give you references. So how can we know that you are preaching the truth to us, Swami? Well, then don't come. Show up the next day, go directly to the sandwich room, collect your sandwich and go home. Don't stay for this sermon. This is for open-minded individuals. Does it not say on the banner somewhere? This is for open-minded individuals. Those who seek salvation, liberation. Because I don't like it when you are served with a different spoon just because you are lay. In other words, just because you know, for those who have to live a lay life, I take their side. Those who want to live a lay life, I didn't say anything, just. Because there are those who want to do it and there are those who have to do it. For those who have to do it, they have no option, I am on your side. I am on your side, I promise you, I am on your side. This is why these things come to us from the universe. Help them. Remind them that the Buddha served us all equally. That even when you're given the five precepts, it is no less an invitation. It is no less a teaching than the teaching that is given to the bhikkhus. Now at the monastery, you see, when we precept you, just before midday alms, the Swaminarayan says, chant along with you until they are done with the refuge, taking refuge. After that, the Swaminarayan and the Anagarika and the Anagarika Matas, they put their hands down. You've seen that. Because we have, now as bhikkhus, we don't observe precepts per se, because it's not something we are administered, it becomes part of our lives. So we don't have an opportunity to observe precepts in that conventional sense. Not five, but 227 precepts is what we have to live by. Just imagine if you were given 227 precepts every day. To give you the five precepts takes about 10 minutes. You would not have time to do anything else. So, I'm not so going to suggest that is why we don't have to precept. It is incumbent upon us to live by those precepts. Our lives are that now. But the Samanera monks and the Anagarikas and the Anagarikas, they observe the 10 precepts. That does not mean that their practice is any less than ours. Because to Nibbana there is only one way. There isn't one way for the bhikkhus, one way for the samaneras, another way for the anagarikas, another way for the upasakas, another way for the dharmistra rajagiriyans. No, there is no such variety. Could someone kindly... Don't let them out. There is no such variety. It's the same path. Ekayanam bhikkhave maggo sattanam visuddhiya. For the liberation of all sentient beings, there's only one path. There's a unitary path. Therefore, when I look at it from that perspective, and I know that among you are those who would choose the noble life so that you can dedicate every living moment of it to practice the noble path, but your obligations and responsibilities and duties, they hold you back. Then I feel there's something more that I have to do. There's a tug in my heart that goes, find what it is that we can give them so that they feel that they have no less a responsibility for themselves than there is for us. And this is the source of some of this insight. So do you understand then? The first precept alone, to really, truthfully adhere to it, takes at least a sotapanna. No one less than that can actually live the first precept of the Dhamma. You can practice the precept. That is why it's called a precept. It is to practice. Shikshana, right? It is to practice. So you can practice it. But the day you become a sotapanna is the day this becomes your natural disposition. In the Sinhala we call it the pihiti sila. Established. It is your established morality. Established because you no longer need to sustain it. It becomes your default morality. Therefore, it does not have to be sustained out of strength, willpower, courage, determination, motivation. You don't need any of that. It becomes your normal, your regular state. Does that make sense to everyone? So, should we go to the second precept or shall we? So, you're all done with the first precept then? Now you want the second precept. If you're going to suggest to me that, okay, Swaminas, give us the second precept now, then I'm going to think from here on that I have an audience full of... Oh, okay, if you say so. But you still want to stay at home. Mara sotapannas. I'm looking for Buddha sotapannas, we have Mara sotapannas. Half sotapannas. Okay. You want me to tell you the second one? What for? What for? Because the second precept is the training a sotapanna must take to become a sakrudagami. You want that now? That's what you're ready for now. So this is the training for your yellow belt. Show me the white belt first. Okay, you get the white belt when you go start your training, right? So this is what comes out as a yellow belt? Green belt. Green belt? It's been a long time since I did any of that. I think it was a green belt. So, show me your yellow belt first. Then I'll show you the yellow belt. Then I show you the green belt, the training for the green belt, and next for the blue belt, and the red belt, and the brown belt. Oh, shall we go to the Suramya Remajpa Madattan? Huh? Shall we do the black belt first? Even if you forget the entirety of today's talk, I want you to take one thing home with you. The Buddha's wisdom. And the profoundness of his teachings. Just reflect for a moment on the profoundness of his teachings. Whether it is right that we, in our ignorance, might undermine it just to think that it's just the precepts. We take it every day. It's become something more like a commodity now. The precepts, it's just a commodity. You can buy it off the shelf. Invite the Swami. Swami, Pansadhan, Swami, Pansadhan. My intention is to show you the beauty of the sasana. I want you to fall in love with the sasana, ladies and gentlemen. I want you to fall in love with the sasana. And as the Buddha once said himself, the more you open up what the Dhamma is, the more it will shine. Its radiance will spread across the universe the more you open it up. If you keep closing it, if you take away the essence of it, then it just becomes another philosophy, another teaching, in a scripture, in a book somewhere, in a manuscript somewhere, in a library. And then we will start to see scholars who go to the libraries to do their research, to write up theses, to submit for their PhDs in Buddhist philosophy. This is not mockery. It's just a remark about the pitifulness that I see. Because the Buddha's intention of teaching the Dhamma to us is not that we can all become scholars in the Dhamma. He gives us medicine for the soul. What good is it for us to become doctors in it if we don't treat ourselves first? That is why. Therefore, don't ever take anything lightly if you know that it has come to you from the Buddha. He is no ordinary man. He looks ordinary, but he's not ordinary. He lives among us, but he's not one of us. We have to try and become one of him. So you tell me the five precepts, is it just for the Buddhists? Just for the Buddhists. Exactly. This is not about a religion. This is a teaching for freedom. This is the path to freedom. See, path to freedom from your sense of self. That is Panatipata Veramane Sikkhapada. Train. Train to be free from a perspective that makes you think that there are two categories of people in this world, beings in this world, those who have what you want and those who don't have what you want. Therefore, you keep on siding with those who have what you want and you think those who don't have what you want deserve your pity. Whenever you feel that way, you're the one who deserves pity. This is enough for one lecture. Actually, this is enough for a whole year. But you want the second precept. Okay. Adinnadana Veramani Sikkhapada. What is the translation of Adinnadana Veramani Sikkhapada? To refrain from stealing. Stealing that, how do you define stealing? What is theft? To take something that does not belong to you. To take something that does not belong to you. What does that imply? That there are things that belong to you. Gotcha. Are you falling in love with the Buddha? Good. That is what I want. I want you to understand the Buddha. Yo dhammam passati so mam passati is what he said. When you see the Dhamma, you shall see me. You can't look at him physically and understand what the Buddha is. But once you start seeing the Dhamma, oh my Buddha. So if theft is to take something that doesn't belong to you, that suggests, does it not, that there are things that belong to you. Taking which is fine. So to take that which belongs to you is okay, isn't it? Well then, let me tell you, ladies and gentlemen. This is nothing to do about taking things that belong to you or to refrain from taking things that don't belong to you. It is your thinking that there are things and a sense of belonging. The whole concept of belonging is your theft from the universe. The very moment that you think that there are things that belong to you because you have a sense of you, a sense of self, to think that there are things in this world that belong to you, that in and of itself is theft. Who does the universe belong to? No one. Who does your car belong to? You. Who does your house belong to? Who do your children belong to? See? But what does your mind tell you? That they belong to? You. If you take the wallet, the money in your wallet belongs to you, but the money in another and someone else's wallet belongs to them. Therefore, if you pickpocket, that's theft. I want you to know that theft is not a physical action. Theft is not a physical action. It's an intention. It's the intention of belonging. That is theft. The moment you think that there are things in this world that belong to someone, whether that is you or someone else, right? This whole concept of belonging. The moment the concept, because it's a concept. No such thing exists in the real world. There's nothing that belonging does not really exist in the outside world. Outside your mind, it does not exist. In fact, in the wise mind, the mind with no ignorance, it does not exist. But the moment you infiltrate the mind with a bit of ignorance, now a sense of belonging comes in. That is theft. What have you stolen by this point? Physically, what have you stolen? If they tried you at court, are you guilty? Oh no. Because you haven't stolen anything. But the concept of belonging, the moment that comes into your mind, now that is the premise, that is the foundation of theft. You see, let me explain to you further. The moment that you think you are you, then what's the first thing that belongs to you? You. You belong to you, don't you? Yeah, you belong to you. That's why I keep telling you, no, you belong to me. But you keep saying, no, Swaminathan, I belong to me, not to you. And if you can somehow convince me, I will come with you, but I still belong to me. I don't belong to you. Then what more to be said about your children? They belong to? Of course they belong to you, because if you belong to you, then surely your children obviously belong to you. Whereas I keep telling, no, your children belong to me, you also belong to me, but you keep denying that. Because you're all a bunch of? Thank you. And you want to observe the precepts. Alibabas. So your body, who does that belong to? What does your mind tell you? That is theft. That is theft. I will have you know that that is theft. Your clothes, who do they belong to? Well, that is theft. Your plate, your cup, your mug, your house, your car. Your apple tree, you don't have apple trees here, do you? Mango tree. Your banana trees, your plantations, your gardens, your coconut tree at home. It's not to have the tree there, it's the thinking that it's yours, that is theft. Do you remember once I explained to you the difference between dhima and dana? Dhima is I give to you, dana I give up. Not give to you. I give up. Give up what? My sense of ownership. That is dana. Dana is the opposite of adinada. Adinnadana veramani. There's a story, I think you've heard this and I've shared it with you once or twice before as well, of a bhikkhu who was once walking along the road and he smelt a fragrance, the fragrance of a flower, at which point he was not being very mindful at the time, is how the story goes. So he picks the flower up and he holds it to his nose to smell the fragrance of this flower. Observing this, he said there was a deity in a nearby tree. And at that point, the bhikkhu hears the word thief. You thief. The bhikkhu hears these words. So he's startled by this and very confused because he's not thieved anything, he's not stolen anything. But why was he deserving of that accusation? Because it's not anyone's garden. He was just walking along the public road. It was just a flower, it belongs to everyone. It's just a tree. The flowers belong to just about anybody. It does not legally belong to anyone. So why was that accusation still a valid one? Because he was thieving something for himself. The moment you take something for yourself, that is theft. Because you don't exist. Really. But when you live in this world and you live in this universe, when you feel that there are things that should belong to me, there are things that should be mine, there are things that I should gather and collect and keep for myself, this sense of idea of myself, folks, that is theft. That is theft. I'm talking to those on the noble path to liberation. You will not be imprisoned for this. Because in a court of law, you are not guilty. You are innocent. But in the court of Dhamma, you are guilty as charged. Now, a sotapanna, a stream enterer, is someone who has now come to a realization that this sense of self is the problem. So, his journey henceforth is to free himself from this feeling of an identity, isn't it? That's now his journey's effort. The Buddha speaks of two types of defilements, two major categories. One is called the defilements related to objects. This is what we call the vastukama, or sensuality related to objects. Object-associated sensuality. Then there's another one called klesha kama. Defilement-associated sensuality. Two types of defilements, but sensuality. Two categories of sensuality. One is related to objects, and the other is related to the sensual experience. Let me explain to you what I mean by these two things. We've spoken about sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. These are the five senses. Through these five senses, we enjoy sensuality. When you enjoy sensuality, when you like sensuality, when you like sights, sounds, smell, taste, and touch, you want to keep on experiencing those things because you like them. And food is a very good example of this. It's a recent example that was discussed when Guru Handra came around, so I will take that example again. He talked about yellow rice, remember? And he spoke of how this yellow rice has a particular color. At least we think that the color is in the rice. And if there's a particular smell, you think the smell comes from the rice. If there's a taste, you think that the taste comes from the rice. So, when your view of this world is that your sight, sound, smells, taste, and touch, these sensations are things that you can achieve by associating with objects, because it is the objects themselves that have these intrinsically. In very simple words, to think that this purple is in the color, sorry, it's in the flower. This color is in the flower, and you like this color, okay? If you like this color and you think that the color is in the flower, what do you want to do with this flower? You want to keep it with you. You want to associate with it. Means you want to acquire objects like this. Don't you? You would want to acquire objects like this. Why would you want to acquire objects like this? Because it has a color that you like. See, take each word in that sentence. It has the color that you like. Once again, it possesses the color that you like. But where is color born? In the mind. Is it in the medium between the flower and the mind? Is it in the brain? Is it in the object then? No. So color is nowhere in between the flower and my brain. It's only when the chitta arises is purple born. So really purple is a chitta. It's not even a color, frankly. It's a chitta. But if your ignorance tells you that purple is in the flower, that this flower possesses purple, and you like purple, what would you want to do? You want to acquire this object, don't you? This is what the Buddha talks about or means when he says that sensuality is twofold. One is object associated and the other is defilement associated. So when you think that these sensual sensualities, when sensuality is associated with an object, then you want to acquire these objects, keep them for yourself. But as your understanding of the Dhamma progresses, and you begin to understand further the workings of the mind, and that these experiences are not intrinsic in the object, you start to lose interest in acquiring objects. Not to suggest that you don't have the desire to associate the sensual feelings. You still want sight, you still enjoy sight, you still enjoy sounds, you still enjoy taste, you still enjoy them, but you have come to this point, this juncture, where you understand that they are not from the object. The objects are not their source. They don't exist in the object. Therefore, if they don't exist in the object, what would be the point of me acquiring the object when particularly you understand that the acquisition of the object also brings you a whole host of other problems, such as maintenance, such as security, safety, sustenance, nourishment. You've got to keep the object safe. You've got to keep nourishing the object for as long as you think that the object is the source of your sensual experience. How many times did you go wrong with that one? You like what you saw. You thought it came from him/her. And then what did you do? You brought home the object. Object. I'm reminded of the Sinhala word for that. You brought home the object. And now what do you have to do? Now you have to maintain the object. You got to keep it safe. You got to keep it safe from the others who also want that object. There are always onlookers, people who are wishful and people who are, what's the word? They are, I think the word is ignorantly blissful. Something like that. Ignorantly blissful or something. What that suggests is they don't know. They don't know the ins and outs of this. They don't know all the effort that has to go into maintaining this. Therefore, they are blissfully ignorant. That's the way it goes, not ignorantly blissful. They're blissfully ignorant. So they're blissful as they observe the object, but out of their ignorance, they don't understand that it requires a lot of maintenance and security and safety and all the safeguards you have to keep it to maintain it like that. So this is the next jump up before you get to anagami state. A sakrudagami individual is someone who still seeks pleasure in the sensual experiences, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch. But they have no interest in the object. They understand, don't get me wrong, they understand that in the absence of the object, they would not have the experience. Because if I took this away, you would not see purple. That is different to wanting this object. Because if you have understood now that color is not in the object, you still want, if you could take the color without the object, wouldn't you opt for that? Just imagine that mindset. If they could have the color without the object, a sakrudagami person would nod their head to that. Yes, I'll have that place. If they could have the taste without the food, If they could have smell without the flower, if they could have the picture but without the painting, they'd be happy to accept that. More than happy. In fact, that is their natural disposition. No pursuit of objects. They have given up their pursuit of objects. Therefore, their mindset is typically one like this. If it comes to them, they enjoy it. But they have lost interest in going after them. So they don't go looking for sensual delights. If it comes to them, they enjoy it. Because they don't go looking for those physical objects, and certainly not engage in the process of acquiring those objects and all the effort that has to go into acquiring those objects. So then to acquire an object, thinking that the sensual experience that you seek comes from the object. Let me turn it around once more. If you are looking for a certain sensual experience and you think that it's in the object, what would you do next? You want to acquire it and make it whose? Make it mine. What is that called? Stealing. That is stealing. If you think that a smell comes from the flower, the fragrance comes from the flower, and because you want that smell, you go and acquire the flower and then start thinking that the flower belongs to me, at least, whether be that temporarily or permanently. That makes no difference. Whether you want to keep it for the rest of your life or you want to take it for a couple of seconds, that makes no difference. The moment you take physical possession of an object, it can be a living object, it can be a non-living object. Okay? The moment you do that, what you have done is stealing from the universe. Please remember, ladies and gentlemen, stealing does not happen between two individuals. We can look at it like that for our conventional understanding of the world, because that's how laws are formed, that's how conventions are written, that's how laws are written, and so on. One party, another party, one party thieves from the other party. That's how contracts are formed, that's how the laws are done, drafted. That's how the constitution works. I'm talking about the truth, the universal truth. In the universal truth, you and I don't exist. He and she doesn't exist. Neighbors don't exist. Friends don't exist. Enemies don't exist. All that exists is energy. And all of energy belongs to the universe. All of energy not belongs to the universe. All of energy is the universe. Therefore, when you think that you are separate from the universe, or you want to take something from the universe for yourself, this is theft. This is stealing. What do you have in your fridge at home? What goods? Stolen goods. In your fridge at home, you have stolen goods. In your cupboard, in your bedroom cupboard, what do you have in there? Stolen goods. On the TV stand, what sits? A 35-inch? No, 75-inch? 100-inch? Stolen item. Where you keep your shoes, what's all that? Pairs of stolen things. Because they're all yours. Remember, this is the intention. It's not the position of the good, the item. It's not the physical position of the item. You can change the coordinates and that is not theft. Okay? Changing this from XYZ here to XYZ there is not theft. Theft is an intention. You can even keep it here, not move it one inch, but then think, this is mine. What is that? Theft. Why would one think that this is theirs? because of their thinking that there is some kind of sight, sound, smell, taste or touch that is innately in this object or intrinsically in this object, that is part and parcel of this object. Therefore, if I wish for that, I have to acquire this object. That thinking is theft. That is why I explained to you, a Sakrudagami individual has come to an understanding through the practice of Dhamma that these sensual experiences are not part of the object. Therefore, for them, Adinnadana Veramani is their natural disposition. They have no interest in pursuing physical acquisition of objects, be that living or dead, or rather, live or living or non-living. Are you still looking for a wife? Or a husband? A girlfriend? Boyfriend? Are you still looking for someone to keep by your side, hold hands, look into their eyes and spend hours talking to them, sharing romantic words with them, because you like what you hear, you like what you see? I'm not going to say the other ones, wouldn't be nice. Because you think all of those things come from the object? I mean, isn't that why you want to bring someone home and keep by your side? Because you think that sight, sound, smell, taste, touch come from the object? You tell me. Is this Buddhism or is this the truth? It's not Buddhism, this is the truth. So, you observe the second precept. Adinnadana Veramani Sikkhapadan Samadhiyami, and then you go and get on the Poruva. Because you want to get married. How do the two of them agree? Why does one want to get married? Because they want to spend the rest of their lives with them, or at least, maybe not the rest of their lives, at least they want some commitment. They're not just looking for safety, you know, in old age and all that. That's not the only thing they're looking for. They're not really just looking for a nurse. They're looking for eye candy. Yeah, ear candy, smell candy, taste candy, touch candy. That's what they're looking for. Thinking that those things come from the object. Therefore, the acquisition of the object. Do you see that the moment you think in those terms, you have already broken your precept? You haven't stolen from anyone yet. Because it is not from someone theft happens. For theft to happen from someone, then that object must belong to them in the first place. Mustn't it? But if nothing belongs to anybody, because we don't exist, then we are not stealing from anyone. Theft happens from the universe. It is your intention that is theft. Therefore, the precept that the Buddha gives to the Sotapannas is Adinnadana Veramani Sikkhapada Samadhyam. Take on this precept and train yourself now, so that you can cultivate your mind to a point where you can give up your pursuit of material objects and the thinking that they belong to you. Do you see how, ladies and gentlemen, the second precept, once perfected, is the natural disposition of a Sakrudagami individual? Just a few toffees from the Buddha. As you hear these words, how do you feel the Buddha in your heart? Can you even begin to imagine, wrap your head around this infinite source of wisdom? I'm just a mere mortal. I'm trying to explain to you the very little that I understand from what I have heard and how my mind understands it, based on my practice, based on my Sila Samadhi Prajna. But we are talking about something that was given to us by infinite Sila Samadhi Prajna. He grew it in his garden. I'm cutting it and cooking it and giving it to you. I'm just the chef. He's the farmer. He's the farmer. I'm cooking it and giving it, serving it to you, because otherwise it's not edible, raw. But he's the farmer. I'm just the chef. I know, you can listen to this entire sermon. I can teach you about all of the five precepts, and you'll walk away and you'll live the regular life that you always lived. Because you can't give up any of this in the circumstances that you find yourselves. How can you start to all of a sudden think that, no, this is not mine, this is not mine, I don't care. You can't live that kind of a life because you are expected to thieve. Society expects you to steal. This stealing, they expect you to do. You are not allowed to steal from someone else. You're not allowed to steal from your neighbors. But you are allowed to grow flowers in your garden, in your backyard, right? That's allowed. Yeah? That is theft as well. So society expects you to steal. Society expects you to commit the first sin. To nurture the sense of self. And look at others as either being api or pata. So that you can go and please them. You can go and tell them please. Or you can go and please them. That is what society expects of you. So society actually expects you to not adhere to the precepts. The precepts in the way that I'm sharing with you now. But in the very conventional sense, of course, no one expects you to kill, no one expects you to steal, no one expects you to indulge in sensual acts outside the parameters that you're legally allowed to. No one expects you to lie. That is what society says, but lying is a whole other kettle of fish. When I start talking about lying to you, you will tell me, Ramana, that's enough. I mean, there's not a snowball's chance in hell that we can do that. To refrain from that level of morality is impossible. Take the very first precept. Is it an easy task to refrain from that? To live by that level of morality? I'm talking about the path from Sotapanna to Arahanthood. This is the level of morality, ladies and gentlemen, that's going to take you one day, someday, to Nibbana. I won't talk to you about the other precepts today. This is enough to keep you on your toes, I think. Because the more I talk to you, the more disappointed you will become. More frustrated, more frustrating it will be. Heck, I thought I was a good Buddhist. I thought I always observed the precepts and never broke the precepts. Now I realize I haven't even started. But the thing is, everything has its levels. Okay? So, like when I did my martial arts, we had the punches, we had the kicks. The same punches and the same kicks, they became advanced as you went up the ranks. So the first, when you were in the lowest rank, you were just a white belt. The whole point was just to protect yourself from harm. So it was more defensive than any amount of offensive attack. It was more defense. Only later on did you learn that you can also use some of the same punches to inflict damage. Initially it was to protect yourself. So like I said, same kicks, the same punches, but chits and panchas, that's all you have. And gods, that's all you have, but to different levels. So, don't become frustrated. The intention is not that. But at the same time, I want you to, like I said, you know, even if you forget the entirety of this sermon, if only you walk away today realizing that it's not just a few trophies, it's not just a 5-pack. The 5 precepts? It's not just a 5-pack. It's not like 5 bags of crisps you can buy to buy at once. This is not a 5-pack. Each of these is a well thought out, masterfully engineered step on your journey, your noble life to Arahathood. Each one is a project in and of its own. Each one of them takes a lifetime of practice. Why? Because they were given to us by the Buddha. So once you have perfected the first and second, you let me know. Then I'll teach you about the third one. Okay. I mean, until then, what's the point? What would be the point of me telling you how to become an anagami individual? If you have a kitchen full of stolen goods, and even today on your way back home, you're going to be stealing. You're going to go stealing to fill your fridges up with that and your homes up with stolen goods. Every moment you're not an arahant, you're committing a sin. I think that's the simplest way to put it. Every moment you're not an arahant, you're committing a sin. And sins are punished. What is the punishment? The 11 great fires. When do they come? A week later? Then? Instantly. Instant punishment. That's why life is so difficult, because you're not an arahat yet. I wish you well, ladies and gentlemen. In my prayers and in my determination, I wish you well. My blessings are for you to be free from this menace. I encourage you to take this noble livelihood, take the noble path, come forth. Because this is the only freedom. Everywhere else is just suffering in one form or the other. Those who have suffer because they have to keep them safe. Those who don't have suffer because they don't have them. Therefore, they are both suffering. Only those who don't want are the ones who don't suffer. Tanha jayati soko. Tanha jayati bhaya. Bhaya is fear. Fear of protecting those things you have because someone or something might take them from you. Soka is grief because you don't have. So tanha jayati soko, tanha jayati bhaya. Tanha vipa muttas. To be free from tanha, natti soko kuto bhaya. No fear, no grief. This is the solution. Therefore, freedom from attachment, freedom from tanha is the only path to happiness. Every man and woman who's tried otherwise have failed catastrophically. You decide what you want to do. Let's leave it there for today then. Let us all take a moment then, ladies and gentlemen, to transfer the merits that we have all acquired today by making offerings to the infinite virtues of the Noble Triple Gem, inviting the Swami Nuhas to deliver the sermon, as well as creating a conducive environment for all to come along and practice the Dhamma. First and foremost, let us transfer these merits to the bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, upasakas and upasikas, who have since time immemorial protected and preserved the sublime teachings of the Buddha and passed it down through the generations of the noble lineage in the form of the Tripitaka, which is thankfully available to us today to study, understand and comprehend the Dhamma. It has also transferred these merits to the Mahanayaka Theras, the Anunayaka Theras of all the chapters who sacrificed their lives to protect the Sambuddha Sasana. It has also transferred these merits to the monks and nuns resident in your local temples and nunneries who have always been by your side through thick and thin, come rain or shine. And my teacher Guru Swami Mahanse, as well as all the monks resident at the monastery and the Anagarikas and Anagarikas attached to the monastery. It has also transferred these merits to our mothers and fathers, brothers and sisters, sons and daughters, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins, nephews and nieces, our friends, our acquaintance, our employers and our employees, as well as anyone and everyone who helped us, supported us and assisted us in any way, shape or form. May by the power of these merits they be healed of any physical and mental ailments and overcome any obstacles to their spiritual progress. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also take a moment to transfer these merits to the Devas and Brahmas, spirits and demons, primarily the Sakadeva, as well as all the gods and deities who have committed themselves to protect and preserve the Sambuddha Sasana. Let us also transfer these merits to our guardian deities who keep a watchful eye over us and keep us out of harm's way. May they prosper in divine power and wisdom. May they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Let us also transfer these merits to our forefathers, our ancestors, relations who have passed away in our name, reminding ourselves that it is in their blood, sweat and tears today we are able to enjoy the comforts of life as we do and practice the Noble Path in peace and harmony. Let us also transfer these merits to members of the armed forces as well as the police force who sacrifice their lives to protect the peace and harmony of our nation, as well as those who have committed themselves to the safekeeping of our nation, development of our nation and the protection of our nation. Let us also transfer these merits to those who lost their lives in natural disasters and calamities such as the tsunamis and earthquakes, landslides, fires, floods, pandemics and so on. Reminding ourselves that in this infinitely long journey of samsara, they will all have been parents to us, siblings to us, friends of ours. They will have gone out of their way to help us, support us and assist us. And therefore, with a sense of gratitude and a sense of loving kindness and compassion towards all that they have done for us, let us transfer these merits to all of them. By the power of these merits, if any of them have been born in the woeful planes, may they redeem themselves and be born in the blissful plane. May by the power of these merits, they abstain from the unmeritorious deeds, fulfill the meritorious deeds, fulfill the Noble Eightfold Path, and may they all attain the supreme bliss of Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. And finally, may by the power and blessings of all the merits we have acquired throughout the day, we be able to witness the advent of many hundreds of thousands of arahants on this blessed land. And finally, may you and I and everyone who's helped make this program a success become a Rahatan Mahanse or an Arahat Teranin Mahanse in this very life itself and in the era of this Sri Sambuddha Sasana itself. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. May the blessings of the Noble Triple Gem be with you all. The Mahasangha will transfer the blessings to you. Raga ginnen nidatva Dvesha ginnen nidatva Moha ginnen Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva Mamada siyalu loka siyalu satvayo Nibbana parama sukhayan sukhita taravetva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetva Nibbana parama sukhayan Sukhita taravetva Raga gini niveva
dveshagini niveva mohagini niveva nivansapaleva nivansapaleva நிவன்சபலதேவ
துன்வன்கே சுவிசி அனந்த மகா குணபலின் சிறு லோக சிறு சத்தியமும் நிபான பரமசுகேன் சுவிசி தருவேத்வா சாதம் சாதம் சாதம்.